Seeds while I was sleeping, and the vision that was planted in my brain.
It's a matter of time, I suppose.
Welcome to Watchmen Minute, where we take a look at the director's cut of Zack Snyder's Watchmen 1 minute at a time. My name is Travis Bowe from the Real Comic Heroes podcast.
I'm Eric Nash.
And I'm Scott Carelli from DuelingGenre.com.
Welcome, Scott.
Thanks, Travis. Eric.
Good to have you.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. I feel like we've got one of the pillars of the movies by minutes genre on the show today.
Yeah. I guess I have enough shows to earn that title.
I think
but,
so.
Yeah. It feels weird. But
okay. Yeah. Just yeah. Accept it. You're on the Mount Rushmore of movies by minutes.
That's a bizarre thing to think about. Yeah. But all right.
And I think the second time we've had a Chicago meet you know, movies by minutes meetup guy.
Yeah.
Here with us.
We had
Yeah.
Harper. Yeah. George. Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, okay. You already had George on. That's
George Hendricks. Yeah. Yeah. So minute 31 starts with Dr. Manhattan and Laurie discussing how he perceives time, and ends with him explaining Laurie's immediate plans to Laurie. And oh boy, this is a minute that I'm nervous about, because it's the first time we'll have some flashback stuff that we're going to get numerous times throughout the movie. So mm-hmm. It's not necessarily a problem this time, because it's, you know, the first time we're getting a lot of this stuff, but we're going to be covering this scene later on, like, and later on. So, Scott, you've got some experience talking about time travel related scenes. So, any advice?
That's true. I don't know, because we on Back to the Future Minute, we talked about the clock tower sequence.
Yeah.
You know, once in every movie. By the time we got to the third movie, we were like, yep. It's the clock tower sequence again.
Yeah.
Because we didn't really know what else to say. It was it'll get rough. Luckily, I don't think there's any moments in this movie that are repeated to the extent of the clock tower sequence, because that's like the entire sequence. Like three times, once in each movie. Just be glad you don't have like 5 minutes of material repeated.
Yeah.
That's rough.
Right on.
We have smaller things like the Minutemen picture.
Yeah.
Being
yeah.
repeated. You know, it's like, right. Well, we're not going to go over all the people that are in that picture yeah. each time.
Right. Right.
That's for dang sure. Manhattan's comment of the perceived time as I do, and I don't think I maybe could have talked about this a little before in some previous minutes, but this is the one where I put my foot down on, not in a aggressive way or anything, but I wonder, is Dr. Manhattan a Tralfamadorian, if you know what that is?
I do not.
I'm pretty sure Travis doesn't.
No, I don't. I'm okay. Unfamiliar with that term.
Slaughterhouse 5.
Mm.
Okay.
Kurt Vonnegut book and then movie. And they're a race of beings that perceive time all at once.
Hmm.
So that's...
Okay.
That's his stating that really makes me think about that species of being.
Huh.
Hmm. Well, I could certainly see Alan Moore, taking inspiration from that. Because, when you look at a lot of his more popular works, Watchmen and League of Extraordinary Gentlemen in particular, they're both sort of his take on a pre-existing property or properties.
Oh, yeah.
So that seems to be something that he's very comfortable with is... taking something that people recognize and, you know, using it in a story that they don't recognize. I could totally see him, kind of reading Slaughterhouse 5 and using that as a pin in the Dr. Manhattan character.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I saw that that word in the in our kind of behind the scenes notes, and had no. I was hoping that that would come up with an explanation, because I was like, I don't know what this is. So I hope that this is something I'll, you know, learn about. But I noticed in that the perceived time as I do line, his words don't really match up with his lips, kind of with that line, because I don't know. They're kind of they kind of do the he's in the foreground and getting blurred slightly, because we were focusing then on Lori, and yeah, just the movement of his lips don't seem to match the dialogue. But
I will say, as far as Dr. Manhattan's sort of depiction in this movie, I find the fact that, like, okay, so, like, I just rewatched this today before recording this, and am I mistaken? Did I like look away from my TV or something? Did they not go into the fact that his dad is a watchmaker?
They don't talk about it much, but obviously that's a big part in the John Osterman kind of segment of the movie. They show him as a young man, late teen, with his father, and is kind of, I think, is meant to imply, like, that's where he learned how to reassemble the watch,
right?
By, you know, and that's what led him to reassemble himself.
Right. And yeah. But that's what it is in the comic, but I don't remember them really going into it in the movie,
which
makes all of this this sort of, like, knowing how things work. I mean this whole thing with this machine that he's building is very reminiscent of, like, you know, watch building. Like,
yeah,
that's what it's supposed to be. And I just found it strange that they didn't really, especially considering the movie's called, you know, Watchmen. But then again, they also changed the fact that their team name was Watchmen in the movie, whereas it's Crime Busters in the comic. So yeah. I don't know. There's a lot of things going on there that I find their adaptation of Dr. Manhattan is very strange to me, because – you know, obviously they're trying to set up something very specific, a very, very large, major, huge change that they're made to the comic.
Yeah.
And so I think that they're, you know, tweaking him here and there for that purpose.
Yeah.
Which I don't want to get too far into, because I don't know how much you guys like to talk about future stuff, but yeah, I don't know. It's interesting. I find every time I watch this, I'm most interested in what they did to him because of what they do in the third act.
Okay. Yeah.
And one of those things that I was kind of distracted by this time was the lack of the you know, there's sort of like a hint. I think I remember like a pan across a table of watch parts,
right,
and things like that. But, like, they never, I don't think they ever, like, outrightly say, like, oh, my father was a watchmaker, you know? And he taught me how to make watches.
Yeah. There is a line where he says, you know, my father was a watchmaker and he gave it up when Einstein, you know, discovered that time was relative.
That's right. That's right. That's right. Okay.
But yeah, so that, and then the flashback to his father and the table of watch parts is really it. So
yeah, but yeah, so that, I just find that interesting. And then as far as Billy Crudup, there's something. So I do like how cold he plays the character.
Sure.
But there's something about his voice that doesn't really sync up to the way that I heard Dr. Manhattan when I was reading the comic.
Okay.
He's a little soft spoken in a way that lacks the gravitas, I guess, that I imagined the character to have when I was reading it.
Godlike being.
Yeah, right, right. and he's just so soft spoken.
Sure. We've talked about that a little bit. Kind of similar. I mean, same thing, soft spoken and cold. Mm-hmm. And I really like it. It works for me. Just his voice. I just really, really enjoy his voice. Because that's most of like what I see this performance as. It's more of a vocal performance. I know he is doing a lot of the motion capture and that kind of stuff, but I don't. It's easy for me to see the character, but then just hear the voice and separate the two. I think the voice really works for me, but I get it. I understand like the feeling that it should be more. I don't know, more booming, maybe more deeper. I don't know.
Feel like it should have more resonance.
Okay.
I don't even think it's Billy Crudup's fault necessarily. I think it's the sound mix is what I'm not. Loving, because I mean you can add resonance to vocals. They did that on, speaking of motion capture, they did that in War for the Planet of the Apes. Is it an orangutan? Yeah, the orangutan. Okay. The sort of main orangutan who only says one word in Maurice, Dawn of the Planet of the Apes. Yeah, Maurice. Thank you. Maurice is played by a woman, and in Dawn, when he says run, they had another actor just, you know, voice that thing. But when they have Maurice speak at the very, very end in a very emotional moment in war... she performed it so perfectly that they didn't want to mess that up. Like, they didn't want to, you know, hire a voice actor to just come in and do,
right,
go over her voice. But she's obviously, you know, feminine. And so what they did was they took her voice down a couple of octaves and then they put it inside of a drum and then recorded it playing from inside the drum to make it sound like the voice was coming out of like a deeper cavity.
Yeah, that's wild.
Yeah, and that's what gives it the sort of resonance that it has in that moment. And I feel like if you had done something like that, where you just kept his performance exactly as is, even that sort of soft spoken, like I almost feel like it would be more otherworldly if he was soft spoken but had a deep resonance like that. It would just be kind of odd, and that's more how I would have pictured his voice. Whereas this feels like a guidance counselor. I don't know.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's a perfect job for him. You know, I see your future as this, you know, this career in line. So.
Right. But anyway.
Yeah.
That's all the things that I had to say about Dr. Manhattan, other than the ending, which
sure.
I'm sure I'll get an opportunity to talk about maybe on Wednesday or something. So
cool. I as far as like what's going on screen, I love that, like, as he reaches his hand out to touch her, and he casts off these little seemingly harmless little bolts of electricity. Mm-hmm. And they don't seem to affect her. Like, they're making contact with her, but it's not like a stun gun, you know. But they are definitely mm-hmm. touching her. But I just like that he – I don't know, just that electricity shoots off of him, but it's harmless. But I don't know. Visually, I like it, because we don't think we get anything like that really in the comic. There's not really these little fine bolts of electricity that
– Mm-hmm. It sort of reminds me of when you – I mean, you know, on Spider-Man Minute, we talk about this a lot with the costume, right? Like,
yeah.
It's easy to draw a costume in a comic and make it very simple. But if you make it simple in film, it looks odd, because it looks kind of cheap. And so they add all of this texture and details to it to make it – sort of stand out more cinematically. And I feel like that's basically the equivalent of what they're doing here, by adding those little, you know, the glow and the little bit of electricity, whatever. But it also seems purposeful, because it seems like the electricity is what's leading her to experience time as him for a second.
Right.
So I don't know.
Yeah.
Of course, she could have been standing there for an hour. We have no way of knowing.
True.
Because who knows how he experiences time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I almost wonder if, like, when the little bolts, like, hit her, if that's what's connecting his mind to her and feeding him the information in order to show her once he, because then he actually touches her with a finger. And that's when obviously she gets hit with the flashbacks that we get in rapid right. succession. Right. And then I through just freeze framing this little sequence of images, we've got it starts with a man with a gun pointed at the camera. Then an edge of paper burning with a lighter with what appears to be the cartoon of Sally in her pinup pose on the lid part of the Zippo lighter. Then there's an empty Night Owl the second cowl, the Mars clock, a framed photo of young Lori with Sally, and then old Sally in rest home. So, and then it kind of lands then on the hallway scene that we spend a little bit of time with. So did either of you guys have any notes or anything to add on those, the flashback of images?
I don't know. What I like about it is, like, right after that, John says, your mind goes to dark places.
Sure.
And I think that does a couple of things. One, it's sort of showing that, Lori has issues with letting go of things, letting go of the past and letting go of, like, you know, the worst things that she's experienced in her life. I kind of like it for that. But then it also tells you something about John, which is that, like, he's sort of indifferent to everything. And so his mind doesn't linger anywhere. It just goes everywhere. And it sort of shows you the difference between the two of them and why she wouldn't be able to handle having his power without being a being like him.
Okay. You know? Always looking back at the dark parts.
Right. Mm. Right. You have to have that cold outlook in order to, you know, be able to experience all of these things at the same time. Or like Sally, your emotions would, or I'm sorry, like Lori, your emotions would, drive you to those darker moments, because those are the things, like, we as humans, we just, like, naturally focus on. Like, I can't even tell you how many times I'll just be, like, sitting around doing nothing and just remember something horribly embarrassing I did when I was 14, you know?
Yeah.
And just be like, ugh. Like, you can't help it.
And then you feel embarrassed and...
Right.
Oh, it's the worst.
I know.
I think that's a real dick move on John's part, because I don't think she's making a decision, or she's not thinking of those times or that moment in her youth. I think he drags this stuff up, and she wasn't expecting. She didn't even ask to, like, show me the past, show me the future. Like, he just does this, and she has a negative reaction to it, you know, or her mind goes to dark places, but that wasn't her decision. She didn't want this to happen. You know, I really don't like the fact that he shows her this dark past and then says, you know, well, this is what happens when you, this is why I keep the worst from you. Like, I really don't like it. And then his next line, he just immediately says, like, say hello to Dan for me, like, almost passive aggressively. And then obviously he explains what he means by that. And it still sounds, it just comes across to me as very passive aggressive. Like,
I mean, it's condescending, but I don't even know that he's capable of being anything but condescending.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Mm. Well, it's either a really good segue or a really bad segue.
Mm-hmm. Mm. Right.
Yeah. Let's back up a little bit and go into the flashback with Sally and her husband, Lawrence, and talk about, Frank Cassini is the gentleman playing Lawrence Schexnader, Sally's husband and former manager, and he was, you know, instrumental in getting her publicity and setting up, like, almost publicity stunts when these guys were all in their youth running around being heroes. He would kind of manufacture, you know, these times where she could show up in costume and foil a bank robbery, which might have just been all staged to begin with, just to get, you know, headlines and that kind of thing. So,
and the actor that you said, Frank Cassini, yeah. I mean, he's another, get ready for this,
yeah,
Scott,
guess
another
where.
Supernatural actor. We've just had a ton of Supernatural guys in Canada.
Yeah, the show Supernatural, yeah.
Right. For these smaller parts.
Yeah, Canadian regular is what I call them. Like, all these guys, you know, shoot all the shows in like the Vancouver area and all that, so... Right. Although he was
lots of TV,
Although he was in Time Cop and Goodfellas, so I did notice that
his first role on our acting role though was Miami Vice.
Nice.
TV show.
Nice,
the TV show.
I think it's interesting that he is credited as Sally's husband,
right?
Movie,
and not
Lawrence. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's interesting.
I like Does Lori get her name from Lawrence? Is that why? Is that why Sally named her Lori?
Maybe to like sort of hide the truth a little bit.
Yeah. I find this whole flashback with everything they're talking about with the putting food on the table for you and your child and calling Eddie. Like, I find it very obvious. We kind of dance around the spoilery stuff in the movie, so I won't go into specifics, but this is obviously a scene that gets referenced a lot in the movie, and I don't know if this is meant to be a big mystery, because for me, having seen the movie quite a few times, I know what they're leading to, but right. I don't know if this is a big mystery the first time the first time viewer, I don't know if this is... that big of a mystery. So,
and there's always having read the book.
Sure.
You know, right.
Too. Yeah.
Right. I don't know because this isn't, I mean, this sequence, isn't like this scene is in the comic, but this doesn't happen in it.
Right.
So I don't know what purpose this serves, in the grander scheme of things other than like, I guess, further separating Dr. Manhattan from humanity for the audience. But I feel like, you know, glowy naked blue guy is enough. I don't know, but maybe not.
Right.
I'm not sure. So I don't really know what this does other than spoil the, you know, the big reveal that's going to happen, you know, two hours from now.
I guess we'll see. So before, obviously before this podcast, I never really paid attention to what's going on with the machinery that Manhattan is manipulating. Mm-hmm. We talked a lot about it last week as far as appearing sort of in an exploded view, similar to a technical manual, which I think does go back to his history with watches and seeing all the parts and pieces laid out in front of him. But I never noticed what was actually occurring. So... I noticed there's this piece that slides out of its housing and then apparently just breaks apart and reforms into like it transitions from, I think, just being metal to glass or crystal and becomes, you know, completely obviously transparent and everything and starts rotating and possibly a hint at Manhattan building things out of crystal in future minutes. Like maybe he's replacing a part that maybe he thought this new piece would serve the purpose better. So I like it. I like the, I really dig that we see him changing the atomic structure of something and getting that hint here. So just a nice little detail of just the, go ahead.
I think that relates a lot to the Charlton comic character that is based on the Captain Atom.
Okay. Yeah.
That deals with atoms. He's, you know, it's more there in his name than Dr. Manhattan.
Sure.
That name, Dr. Manhattan, is just this more impending doom name.
Yeah, yeah.
Also reminds me of Adam Eve from Invincible, being able to change anything into anything else.
Okay.
That power, yeah.
Yeah. Is Firestorm have the same kind of powers, that same level as Captain Atom? Or
I don't know. Can Captain Atom actually do that? or because any appearance I've ever read of Captain Atom, it just seems like a dude in a containment suit. So I'm not totally sure what all of his power sets are, but yeah, that is something Firestorm can do. But I don't know if he can do complex stuff, or just sort of you know, more like, I don't know that he can, you know, turn a gun into a flower. Not sure. Adam Eve can, in Invincible, but I'm not sure. I don't remember Firestorm ever doing something that complex, and I certainly don't remember Captain Atom doing stuff like that. But then again, I've probably only read a handful of Captain Atom comics in my life.
Yeah,
most of
for me. So
Most of my introduction to him was from Justice League Unlimited. In which case he was like more of like a hot-headed tragic figure, because he was just like a gas being inside of a containment suit. So I don't know. I'm not sure.
Yeah. I think most of my exposure to Captain Atom is from one of the DC animated movies. And it's like him, Captain Atom, Major Victory or Major something. And they're like trying to take down Superman. I think it's the Batman and Superman animated.
Public Enemy.
Public Enemy. That's it. Yeah. Yep.
Yeah. It's public.
And so he was, kind of hot headed, kind of not militaristic. Maybe that was the other guy. But just very not a bad guy, but not a good guy either. So almost almost an anti-hero kind of thing. So.
Right.
Okay. So here we go.
What you got?
His D-I-L-U-S-T-E-L skin is tied into the quantum field, which enables him to absorb and manipulate theoretically infinite amounts of energy, limited by his willpower and imagination.
Okay, and that's Captain Atom?
Yep.
Okay.
Yeah. At least one of the versions throughout many.
Right.
Okay. Anything else for 31?
I had the details of the pieces.
Okay.
You know, of the machine breaking apart and coming back together.
Okay.
I didn't have it quite as detailed as you in your description. That made a lot more sense. And then also just all the equipment in the background I found pretty impressive. That sat there and not really noticed in previous viewings, but in the 1 minute.
Yeah.
You notice it then, but I think they're good that they just sit there.
Sure. All right.
You have anything else, Scott?
No, not for this minute.
Okay. So, Scott, why don't you tell us, like, where you're from, what Dueling Genre is, what other shows we can find you?
Yeah. So DuelingGenre.com is the website for the podcast network and production company that I own and run. And we have a great many Movies by Minutes as well as lots of other podcasts. We're the home of Lord of the Rings Minute and Harry Potter Minute and several other ones, as well as Cornetto Minute, which I host with my co-host Nick Jimenez, where we're talking about the Edgar Wright, Simon Pegg, Nick Frost films, starting with Shaun of the Dead, and then we'll eventually move on to Hot Fuzz and The World's End. And we're doing that. Before that, Nick and I did Back to the Future Minute, but that one's wrapped up. So you can go and check out. I think there's 345 episodes of Back to the Future Minute total, including our five-part series finale. Where we talk about Back to the Future, the ride, which I believe both of you were there for in the audience.
Yep.
So you can go check those out. And then I'm also the co-host of Spider-Man Minute with Zach Luna. We're talking about the Spider-Man movies 1 minute at a time. We've covered the first Spider-Man movie directed by Sam Raimi, and we are beginning our pre-production stages for Spider-Man 2. So that's been really exciting. And yeah, we've got a lot of stuff over there. I've been the oldest podcast I think we have is The Doctor's Companion, which is a Doctor Who podcast that I've been hosting since 2009. So that's been going on for quite a while, basically since David Tennant regenerated. that's been going on for quite a while. And we recently, and I say recently, but it was like 2 years ago, we sort of changed up the format. So we do talk about the new episodes as they air. Our last episode was about the Christmas special where Capaldi regenerated into the 13th Doctor. And we're going to be talking about the new season, season 11, when that airs, whenever that ends up happening, probably like fall or something. But we also do this thing called Doctor Who The Long Way Around, where we talk about one story from every Doctor. And so we'll do like, so we did our first season of Long Way Around. We did the first story of every Doctor, and then we did the second story of every Doctor and the third story and so forth. And so we just do one Doctor at a time. And
then you make your way back.
Right, exactly.
And keep doing it.
Nice. Right. So we do one season where we do the first story of every Doctor, and then we take a break, and then we come back and we do the second story of every Doctor, and so on and so forth. And that's been a lot of fun. And obviously, you know, we will be running out of stories because some Doctors were around for longer than others, but thankfully most of them have Big Finish stories, so we can do the audio dramas that Big Finish produces with the original actors who played the roles and stuff. So that's been a lot of fun. That's what we've been doing with the Eighth Doctor, because he's basically only in audio essentially. But yeah, so if you like Doctor Who, please check that out. That's just me, Nick, and our co-host Cassandra Fredrickson, and we just hang out and talk about Doctor Who. And it's really silly and fun. And I go into like the background of like the, you know, the way that the politics of the BBC at the time caused certain things and stuff like that. So it's a lot of fun. There's a lot of backstory and things. And nice. Nick does a really great Stephen Moffat impression that has to be heard to be believed, but it's really good. And then finally, the sort of coup de grace of dueling genre is Geek by Night, the original audio drama that Nick and I executive produce, and we write with a very talented staff of writers, and produce with a very talented group of actors. And it's fully cast with sound effects and everything. It's like listening to a TV show. And it's about a group of friends who run a comic book store together, and they all suddenly and mysteriously get superpowers, and what they do with those powers and why, and all of that is sort of how that sort of affects the city that they live in and everything, is what the show's about. And it's a comedy. There's dramatic moments, but I would say it's primarily a comedy. Check that out if it sounds like something that's interesting. We just finished the first season. It's 15 episodes. And, that's everything that's going on at Dueling Genre, I think.
So not much. So
yeah, just a few things.
Well, very cool. I think that'll do it for episode 31. We will be back on Tuesday for minute 32. So until then, who watches The Watchmen?
We do.
We do.
We do.
Watchmen are over.
Still remains within the sound of silence. In restless dreams I...